Hello and welcome to Banfield. There is word from Kyiv tonight, unverified as of yet, that Ukrainian forces have killed a fifth Russian general. Yakov Rezantsev led Russia's 49th Combined Arms Division, but he may best be known for having bragged on day four of the Ukraine invasion that it would all be over in a few hours. Little did he know. His reported death comes on the same day another Russian general, a big one, safely back in Moscow, gave his first public briefing of the war, and it too was a big one. He said, quote, "The first stage of the operation in Ukraine had been mainly accomplished," sort of leaving out the fact that no major Ukrainian cities have even been captured. And one that was captured early on is now, according to the Pentagon, contested, which means up for grabs. That would be Kherson in the south near Crimea, which Russia seized back in 2014. The Russian bigwig declared, quote, "As individual units carry out their tasks, our forces and means will be concentrated on the main thing, the complete liberation of the Donbass." Wait, hold on, the Donbass? That is way, way over in the east. Could that mean that the Russians are retreating there and starting to realize that the rest of that country is not so easy to conquer? It is the clearest signal yet that Moscow realizes that that dead General Number 5 and all of the people like him who thought that way, they were wrong. Ukraine isn't going down without a hell of a fight. That said, we do know this. Russians continue to hammer the Ukrainian cities that their ground forces just seem to be unable to take. This is Kharkiv, where officials count at least 55 missile strikes in just 24 hours. Take a look at those pictures. At least one of those strikes was a school, and the icicles from the broken water pipes, they show how bitterly cold it must be for the thousands and thousands of civilians who are still living in that carcass of a city with no heat. We also have pictures from Kyiv, where a critical Ukrainian oil depot was blown up from the air. These have been popular and easy targets for Russian airstrikes, and Ukraine has lost several of them. And then there's this, the theater-turned-bomb shelter in the devastated city of Mariupol, where today we learned that at least 300 civilians did not make it out alive after that Russian strike a week and a half ago. President Biden saw none of that in Poland today, but he did see plenty of U.S. troops, whom he sent there to shore up NATO's eastern flank. News Nation's Robert Sherman is there tonight. Robert, the president was like 50 miles from the Ukrainian border, 50 miles from a war zone. So why did he go and what did he do?
Well, as you mentioned, Ashley, part of this was to thank some of the troops that have been deployed to that area, as we've been reporting for the last couple of weeks. A concerted effort has been put in place to shore up Eastern European NATO nations by adding NATO and U.S. troops to the area, asserting that proverbial red line that should the war cross into one of those countries, it would, in effect, trigger Article 5. And all of the NATO countries, especially the powerhouses such as United States, would stand by affirmatively with some of these other Eastern European countries. So that was one of the main messages that we heard the president say today, that it is all about unity. Listen to this statement that he gave earlier today.
Single most important thing that we can do from the outset is keep the democracies united in our opposition and our effort to curtail the devastation that is occurring at the hands of a man who, I quite frankly, think is a war criminal.
And the president did make a point today that it seems as though that the world is at an inflection point, the democracies versus the authoritarian leaders. He says that this is a point in history in which the democracies must be united in order to combat that form of rule. The other aspect here as well is the humanitarian crisis on the ground. And the president said that he wanted to get a closer down-to-earth picture of what the refugee crisis looks like. That was part of this as well, and that was a large portion of the reason behind this trip. 2.2 million refugees have fled here to Poland, far and away leading the pack of all other countries here in Europe. Ashley?
Yeah, and every day we watch that tally, Robert. You know, it was 3.5 for a couple of days, and then today the reports have come in. It's now up to 3.8 million refugees who have fled. So speaking of those refugees, I know that yesterday the president had, you know, telegraphed slightly that he was going to try to meet with refugees. Was that on the agenda still for this trip?
Well, the president did acknowledge that is a bit more difficult this trip in order to get that in-depth look at a lot of the refugees. He said that he wanted to cross the border and go into Ukraine and see the refugee crisis on the other side. His security details said absolutely not. They weren't going to let him go into a war zone. But he mentioned that he felt as though he didn't get quite the up-close look that he's gotten in previous war zones, such as Afghanistan, for example, where he's been to before when it was Senator Joe Biden. So that is an aspect here that he wishes that he could have seen that a little more up-close and personal, but still, nonetheless, here in Poland.
Okay, there's always diplomatically a lot of puzzle pieces when you're certainly dealing with like 30 NATO countries, all with their domestic agendas and their needs and their trade issues. And one of the big sticking points has been liquefied natural gas. The European countries really have been depending on Russia because that's where they get it. And so Joe Biden wants very much for those European nations to stop spending money on Russian gas because that money is going in to kill Ukrainians. Where is he with that negotiation and what's he going to do about it?
Well, at this point, it seems as though that a lot of European countries are in concurrence with the president, that they do need to move away from Russian-purchased fuel. And we know that the United States is going to be sending about 15 billion cubic meters of this liquefied natural gas over to their European partners. One of the countries to watch is Germany, which we know is the vice chancellor said today that they are trying to move away from Russian fuel at an insane pace. That's an actual quote, move that away from Russian fuel over to the United States and other countries in order to not be putting coins into the coffer of Russia on this one. So we are seeing a lot of these countries try and move away from Russian fuel and try and get away from all of that. But of course, there's a lot of logistical hurdles behind this. How do you get all this fuel to them so quickly? How do you make that transition so quickly? It's not an overnight process. So that's going to be where the water gets muddy and how it's going to be a bit more difficult in order to get through.
Okay, not to muddy the water any further, but the water is kind of where that fuel would be transported, I would assume, with tanker after tanker after tanker crossing the Atlantic. And, you know, we haven't had a lot of success in the last couple of years with port traffic. That's been a real mess. The supply chain is almost entirely blamed on the port issue. So how are they going to get around that if they're going to send over fuel? And I've only got about 20 seconds left.
Yeah, I mean, that is a big concern here is that you're going to have to navigate this whole issue with the ports that we've seen as of late. It's going to be a wait and see type of concept as to exactly how they're going to be able to navigate the supply chains in order to make this happen swiftly. But can tell you that it is a chief priority in order to make this happen.
Right. All right. Well, Robert, you've got your work cut out for you. Thanks for following the president for us. And obviously another day on your agenda as well. Robert Sherman, live for us tonight in Poland. You know, it is a rare thing for the Pentagon and the Russian Defense Ministry to hold briefings on the very same day and then give strikingly similar assessments of a war in which they're both engaged, but on opposite sides. News Nation's Kelly Meyer joins me live with that. So, Kelly, the spin was very different on what was being said, but, you know, everybody who listened feels as though it looks like Moscow is regrouping at the very least and maybe even pulling back at the best.
Yeah, that's right. Russian officials basically declaring victory, saying that the first phase of their mission here is generally complete, and they're saying they're moving on to, quote, the liberation of the Donbas. I don't speak Russian, but I would say the English translation of this is that they were unable to take control of Kyiv, and they are changing course, they're regrouping, and they're making it look like it was planned, and they're not admitting the failures of their ground game, which the Pentagon has been describing to us throughout this process. And they're also not stopping, though, the airstrikes. They're continuing those in places like Kyiv, Kharkiv, and in the Donbas. And the Pentagon saying that they're not trying to get into the mind of Putin here. They don't know if this is him cutting his losses and trying to move on to the south or whether they're going to keep trying here. But what is clear is they were not prepared for the Ukrainians to fight back and to fight back for so long. Ashley?
It sort of brings to mind the, you know, the Vietnam era when the Johnson administration had advice given to it, declare victory and go home. And so I'm wondering if that's where the Pentagon is thinking. Clearly no one's in Putin's mind, but to hear that they're sort of regrouping towards the Donbass, it almost makes you wonder if they're looking at this as a negotiation point. We'll stay here, this will be part of Russia, and let's call it a day.
It could be. You know, they did say that could be an option, whether it is a negotiating point, whether they are just going to take the south, cut their losses and move, or if they're going to keep trying here. But it is day 30. This could go on much longer. You know, this may not end. They may keep pushing forward. But again, they are suffering losses, and Ukrainians are switching from defense to offense in many cities, from Kyiv to Kharkiv to, as you mentioned there at the beginning of your show, in Kherson. They assessed for the first time in weeks that they are now fighting to take that back. That is no longer in Russian control. There is heavy fighting in Mariupol. The Russians have not yet taken that. That is something that they are fighting for in the south. So there are areas that they are not gaining and gaining control in. We saw also just that Ukrainians had bombed the Russian warship that was actually carrying supplies. And now the Russians are actually tapping some reinforcements. They're saying they're going to bring in some Russian troops from Georgia to help them. So that's another clear sign that they are needing some assistance here.
So are U.S. officials saying that the Russians are following Plan B, that this is a strategic move, it's sly like a fox, or are they saying this is a turning point that will really galvanize the Ukrainians, especially if the Russians are having to go to the Georgians for reinforcements at this point?
That's right, and it's something that the Pentagon is still trying to assess, but what they do say is clear is the recklessness. They're saying that's there to see. There's a quote here from a senior defense official, I believe we have, that says, quote, "You can see for yourself how they have tried to make up for the fact that they haven't been able to move well on the ground by increasing use of airstrikes and missile strikes and artillery strikes on population centers," as we mentioned, the change from defense to offense for Ukrainians. But again, we don't know what Putin is going to do next. We have discussed here on your show the chances of him moving on to weapons of mass destruction, him turning to chemical weapons. And we discussed as well Biden's warning, saying that we will respond, the U.S. and NATO will respond. Whether that will ring true, whether that is an empty promise, we don't know. But again, this could go on much longer. But what we do know, again, as you said at the beginning of your show, Ukrainians are not going down without a fight.
Yeah, I mean, Kelly Meyer, it's so hard to sort of keep all the balls up in the air at one time if you're in the Pentagon, whether you're more concerned about making sure Ukraine is not lost or whether you're really making sure that we don't end up in World War III. It's quite a navigation. Thank you for that. Appreciate it. Kelly Meyer in Washington for us
Thank
tonight.
You.
The one critical thing that keeps Vladimir Putin from launching a nuclear weapon, like Kelly was just talking about, is that both he and his country would be annihilated by the nukes that we send back, right? We have a way to know if he launches an attack. But what if he could launch a nuclear attack in silence? No missiles, no warheads, no warning. It turns out there is a way. So are we one step ahead? I'll have the answer for you after the break. If you are keeping score, the West has just nailed another success against Vladimir Putin, this time in the information war. Putin keeps the Russian people in the dark about this war. They think it's just a small operation to rescue some Russians. But a Western intelligence agency reportedly infiltrated Russia's largest social media platform. It's the equivalent of Russian Facebook. And when Russians logged into their accounts on Sunday, they were treated to some alternative facts. And when I say alternative, I mean the stuff that the rest of the world actually gets to see. Like the number of Russian soldiers who've really been killed in Ukraine. The Russian military says it's, yeah, I don't know, plus or minus 1,300. But NATO reports it's between 7,000 and 15,000. And Ukraine's is more modest. It has the tally at 13,000. The more you know. You know, it's a small victory amid the greater horrors that are being perpetrated against Ukrainians, but it shows that when it comes to hacking, the West can beat the Russians at their own game. And that may be no more important than right now, especially when it comes to the prospect of a nuclear attack. Now, the conventional wisdom holds that Putin would not launch a nuclear warhead at America because he'd be annihilated, right? By the nuclear onslaught that comes right back at him. We used to call it mutually assured destruction back in the 80s. We still do. But hacking a nuclear power plant in the United States and then causing a nuclear meltdown there, well, that would amount to a nuclear attack without ever firing a missile. Can that happen? Might it happen? Are we prepared? Have we done anything to inoculate ourselves against it happening? Here to help us break it all down is Max Everett. He is the former chief information officer for both the White House and the Department of Energy. Max, you know, if you had asked me that question, I don't know, 5 weeks ago, I would have said, you know, that's just hyperbolic supposition. That sounds crazy. But I also wouldn't have expected that we'd be seeing the pictures that we're seeing out of all of Ukraine either. And I don't think the Ukrainians expected it either. So we're sort of forced to go into imaginative awful. And I'm wondering how much that is imaginative and how much it's actually plausible.
Well, I think it's something that's been a concern for us in the United States and around the world for some amount of time. Certainly when I was at the Department of Energy, we had teams there focused on cybersecurity along with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, Homeland Security and others. And so this was a very important concern. The thought that someone could do anything, whether it's cyber or physical, to cause an incident in a nuclear plant that released radiation, I think that's a nightmare scenario for all of us. So that is something we've been looking at, again, for many years in the United States. And the good news is, in many ways, we are prepared for it.
Well, I'm glad you say that. I don't feel, assuaged at all in my concern. And the only reason I say that is because I sure didn't think that Chernobyl or Zaporizhzhia were possible. Again, if you'd asked me 5 weeks ago, I would have said no one would go near Chernobyl for fear of hurting their own soldiers. And there they shut it down. And there it was on emergency generator power. We lost communication, so we had no idea what was going on there. And then people started to worry that if the generator power were to, say, run out, how would the spent fuel be cooled? Like, how could this not be a disaster, you know, moments from happening? So maybe that got people thinking it could be easy to do it here, too.
Well, I think there's a few issues in the United States that we're more prepared for. But you're right. For many of us, even people who've been thinking about this for years, you know, the pictures of the Russians firing artillery at an operating nuclear plant, the attack on Chernobyl, it does open the door for the thought that they could do the unthinkable. So I think that this has got one of the reasons you saw the recent letter that went out from the president on preparing for cyber attacks. In the U.S., we've done a few things over the last several years what relates to cybersecurity in terms of constantly testing and auditing those nuclear plants, both for their physical security, but also, as you've noted, importantly for their cybersecurity, to make sure that no one could do that unthinkable act of reaching in from the internet and somehow being able to shut down some of those physical processes that are necessary to safely operate a nuclear plant.
You know, when you said just a few minutes ago that we're, you know, we're well prepared, the reason I don't feel as, you know, as certain of that as maybe I should is because the recent news reports that we've been getting of the people they are catching. And I'll just list a couple here. And this is from the Department of Justice. So, you know, it's pretty good information. Three Russian spies were indicted recently for targeting energy infrastructure for 5 years. And they did it in 135 countries. And then you think about energy infrastructures. All right, well, we've got 56 nuclear power plants in the United States. How good is the security apparatus? How coordinated is the security apparatus for all 56 of those disparate nuclear plants?
Well, in those cases, I think the security there is very good, because the good news is we have people who have been thinking about these unthinkable scenarios for many years, who've been looking at those. I think our energy sector as a whole, there is no question there's danger. We all saw what happened with Colonial Pipeline last year. That was just an attack on one company in one part of the energy sector. And the result was you had gas lines and shortages of gas for, you know, a week plus here on the East Coast. So I think it is, you know, reasonable for people to be concerned and ask those questions when it comes to the energy sector. But I would tell you that, you know, certainly in my time at the Department of Energy, working alongside of people at Homeland and other places, there are a lot of eyes focused on protecting our critical infrastructure, and especially around those nuclear plants. Again, all of them typically go through multiple tests every year, both physical and cyber, because, again, it's the idea that that could happen is just unthinkable. And again, I think that's one of the reasons emotionally it's been so difficult to watch that going on in Ukraine, to watch something. Again, I agree with you. No one 5 weeks ago would have thought that we would see someone intentionally firing artillery at a nuclear reactor, because as well designed as we've tried to make those, I don't think anybody could rightfully say they know what would happen in those cases when somebody does something like that.
So I want to play for you something that Jason Weiss said on this program a couple days ago. He's a retired FBI agent, but he's also a current cybersecurity attorney. He knows a thing or two about this. And I asked him about how prepared we were with security at nuclear plants. And I was actually really alarmed at his answer. So I want to play it for you and then ask you about it on the other side. Take a listen.
You know, I'm retired now, so I'm going to be honest. I don't think we're well prepared at all. I mean, at the end of the day, most of our electrical grids are guarded by nothing but a chain link fence and a $10 padlock. When these entities were built, they were not built with cybersecurity in mind.
So I get, you know, what he's saying, and I get what you're saying, that people have had their eyes on this problem for not just the last 4 weeks. But I also feel, I think like a lot of Americans feel, once you're relying on the federal government, or in certain energy, you know, parts of the energy sector, the public, people just screw up, you know, like the government screws up a ton of stuff. And I don't want to hear that the government screws up at a nuclear facility when it comes to the prowess of Russian hacking.
Well, that's very, I would agree with you. I think one thing I would agree with is, I think it's unquestionable that we need additional investment in protecting our energy sector, our energy grid, especially on cybersecurity. The reality he pointed out, and it's absolutely true, is that many of those systems were not designed thinking about cybersecurity from the ground up. There is, I think, an opportunity here for the country to make a bigger investment to go in and really redo some redesign and rebuild. One of the things I've seen in my career in cybersecurity is we've often made the mistake of simply trying to sort of slap cybersecurity on top of systems that already have flaws and issues in them. And this is a case where we probably need a larger reinvestment to make sure that we are building in security by design when it comes to the energy sector, our electric grid. And he's right there again. In many places, you can drive around and you'll see, you know, obviously substations and things, there's just a fence around them. Those are the kind of things that They're going to need more attention. They need more investment. It is a good thing for the American people to see these things and be concerned and ask those questions and make sure that the government is investing in the right places, that they are accountable for results and making sure that we're doing the right things to protect our country.
Yeah, I'm all for paying more taxes if I know it's going to go to that. Max Everett, former chief information officer for both the White House and the Department of Energy, I would really like to have you back, like regularly. Thank you very much.
I'll be glad to do it. Thanks very much for having me.
Appreciate it. Really appreciate it. The war in Ukraine has sent food prices soaring, in case you hadn't noticed. Some countries are already actually rationing food. So could the United States government force you and your family to eat less? Believe it or not, it has happened here before. So could it happen again? That's next. Welcome back to Banfield. If the world runs low on food, who gets to eat and who doesn't? It's a frightening question, and it's actually being considered by world leaders right now because the war in Ukraine could plunge the world into a food shortage. Let me explain a little bit. That Ukraine and Russia together produce nearly 30% of the world's wheat supply, and the war has shut down grain exports from both of those countries. And while we here in the United States don't get a whole lot of our grain from them, there is an even bigger problem looming. Ukraine and Russia also produce a vast amount of the world's fertilizers. According to a senior analyst at the International Food Policy Research Institute, and I'll quote, "The biggest threat that the food system is facing is the disruption of the fertilizer trade. Wheat will impact a few countries. The fertilizer issue can impact every farmer everywhere in the world and cause declines in the production of all food, not just wheat." That certainly raised the alarm around the world. French President Emmanuel Macron said this. His government this week is considering a food voucher program. And supermarkets in Spain and Italy have already rationed the sale of some items like corn and sunflower oil. But they're over there and we're over here. Could it actually happen here in America? Ask your parents and then ask your grandparents, because during World War I, we got a taste of it. Food shortages forced President Herbert Hoover to launch a propaganda campaign trying to get Americans to eat less. And the slogans really took off, too, like "Food will win the war," "Meatless meals," and "Wheatless Wednesday." That campaign actually reduced national food consumption by, are you sitting down, 15%. We could kind of use that now. And then along came World War II. The United States had a full-blown food rationing system at that point. First it was sugar, and then came coffee, and that was followed by meat and cheese and then milk. There were more propaganda posters, too, and this time the U.S. government gave every American, including babies, a book of ration stamps that they would have to bring to the grocery store with them when they shopped. A pound of bacon cost 30 cents back in 1943, but a shopper would also have to rip out and hand over 7 points to buy that bacon. And if you ran out of the ration points, well, that was your tough luck. And while this new war in Ukraine may have escalated the current food problem, there are a few other things that actually started it. The global pandemic and that pesky supply chain disruption, well, those are still an issue, right? U.S. food prices rose 1% just last month. That is the largest monthly increase since April of 2020. But get this, over the past 12 months, U.S. food prices jumped nearly 8%. Eight! And that, my friends, is the biggest jump since July of 81. We also have our own logistical problems here in the U.S. You might remember Hurricane Ida last year. That hurricane knocked out two large fertilizer plants located along the Gulf Coast. Those plants have really struggled to come back into service. And if that weren't bad enough, a fire took out another one, another fertilizer plant, this one in North Carolina. So even if we ourselves wanted to make up the food shortages caused by the war, we probably could not do it. It is just another reminder that what happens in one part of the world can have a huge impact on the entire world, and why the NATO discussions going on in Europe right now could determine what is actually on your dinner table, and maybe more importantly, what isn't. Still to come, her health and her welfare has been the focus of her fans and even those who don't really know her. Wendy Williams has reemerged from a mysterious disappearance off TV and off social media. But a rambling video is raising more questions now than answers. What she is saying, how she is saying it, and why parallels are now being drawn to Britney Spears. When you are larger than life, so is your following. And Wendy Williams has a massive following. Perhaps it's for that reason that speculation about her health and her career and her personal well-being have been running wild for months on end. A mysterious social media account began popping up a couple weeks ago, but it was sort of unclear if that account really belonged to Wendy. There were posts, but you couldn't see her talking. But now we know that account is hers, because now Wendy is talking, and she's talking on camera. But what she's saying, and maybe more importantly, how she is saying it, has got a lot of people worried about Wendy. Our Banfield senior story editor, Paula Froelich, has been following this. Actually, Paula, you've been on the Wendy Williams story for quite a long time, because it is a storied story about Wendy. So what is all the buzz about this latest video that she posted?
Ashley, this weird Wendy saga just keeps getting weirder. So get this. Last week, Wendy called into Good Morning America without appearing on camera and addressed the epic battle over her money, saying, and I quote, "When people want control of your accounts, they say anything." I mean, isn't that true? Wells Fargo and her former financial advisor, Lori Schiller, locked Wendy out of her accounts last month, claiming she was an incapacitated person who could not handle her own affairs and that someone was acting in her best interest. Well, we now know who that someone is. According to the Sun newspaper, her former manager, Bernie Young, whom she fired earlier this year, quietly filed a petition for guardianship over the talk show host in New York courts 2 weeks ago. Now, in that interview, she also said she was going to come back bigger and brighter than ever. But yesterday, she posted a disconcerting video to Instagram demanding access to her money. And while she may have a point, fans were concerned because in the video you're about to see, Wendy was, I don't know, she just wasn't Wendy. She was acting unusual, extremely repetitive, and didn't mention her show at all. Check it out.
My thing is that I've been asking questions about my money. And when I began asking questions about my money, suddenly Lori Schiller has got no response regarding my money. I want my money. This is not fair. And Wells Fargo has no questions and answers with regarding my money. This is not fair. And Lori Schiller and Wells Fargo have this guardianship petition about keeping me away from my money. This is not right. And you know this is not fair. Bernie Young used my American Express card to hire an attorney to file a petition against me. That was done with my American Express card. Bernie Young, you're no good. And this is not fair at all, you know? Former doctor, okay? had medical information about me that I never even got. It was sent over to Lori Schiller. So I haven't gotten the stuff. I fired the doctor. And again, all I want to know is where is my money? This is not right. And certainly, this is not fair. This is not fair. Wells Fargo has used all this stuff to create the guardianship over me. This is not right. And certainly this is not fair. The New York court system is, they, you know, without evidence, they're being weird to me, this court system. Without evidence, they took all this information and continued with what's going on with me based on what Wells Fargo is doing. This is not fair. This is not fair. Lori Schiller, Bernie Young, and Wells Fargo. Please let me have access to my money. This is not right. And again, this is not fair. Have a pleasant day. Thank you.
Wow. I mean, those are some shocking claims. So I reached out to both Bernie Young and Lori Schiller, as well as Wendy, but I got no response. But here's the deal, Ashley. I mean, I just got to say, whether or not she's out of it, she has a point. It is her money. She did make it. And now people whom she fired are trying to keep her from her. Mm-mm. As Wendy would say, it's not right. I mean, I know a lot of people with mental health problems, and they can still cash their checks. Why not Wendy?
So, I look at that tape, and I just see a woman who is no longer anything, you know, like she used to be. I mean, she's a broadcast titan. And I wonder if there's always two sides, and then there's the side we know nothing about. And I just wonder if there is someone else out there who is acting in a predatory way around Wendy, and if perhaps these people she names are trying to protect her. But it's very uncomfortable to see her in that manner. And again, just the things that she was doing, her body language, her eyes, her tucking her chin into her turtleneck and constantly playing with her hair. I was worried about the woman I used to know personally and the woman I don't know at all in that video.
It's just so upsetting, you know, and here's the deal. Even if people are trying to protect her from other people in her life, it's still her money. It's her life. You know,
someone's trying to steal it, right? I guess that's the only reason. And yeah. I do find it weird as well. And maybe, you know, this is just chewing this issue out. But it seems to me when women have these issues, it's more of a crisis than if a man, like maybe Kanye, has mental health issues. Does anybody come swooping in to say Kanye needs a conservator?
Ding, ding, ding. You are correct. I mean, look at Kanye. He's losing it everywhere. And Wendy is keeping it together, at least ish in public.
Well, I don't know.
I mean, ish.
I think that one's up for debate.
Yeah,
ish. Big ish, right? Paula, keep on it. I know that you have great sources on this story, so keep us updated. I'm really worried about Wendy. I like her very, very much. I know her personally, and I am very worried about her.
She
so thank you for bringing that
to us. She is a national treasure.
Yeah, she is. I agree. All right, thanks, Paula Froelich. Have a good weekend. Do appreciate it. 4 weeks of tragedy, 4 weeks of wall-to-wall news, 4 weeks of death and destruction in Ukraine. It can all start to blend together. But sometimes it takes just a tiny little voice to bring it all into hyper-focus.
If they drop bombs on us, everything will be destroyed.
Straight ahead, the voice that rose above all others this week. There was this old expression when I was growing up, and it was children should be seen and not heard. And I never liked it, and I still don't. Especially when I see a little girl like 3-year-old Kira Karazi from Kharkiv, Ukraine. Kira and her mother, Anna, had to pack up in a hurry, and they had to leave everything they knew behind when the bombs, you know, started falling all around them. And when I say everything, I mean everything, like Kira's dad. They had to leave him behind, too. So if you're wondering what it's like for a three-year-old to process all of that, well, I'll just let Kira tell you in her tutu and her headlamp.
You have to switch off the lights so that they do not drop the bomb on us. If they drop bombs on us, everything will be destroyed. We need to switch off the lights. If turned off, the enemy planes looked and flew away.
Kira, her mom, and her two grandmothers escaped all the way to Spain, 2,300 miles away, where a family has taken them in for the time being. There's no word yet on how her dad is doing back on the battlefield. And that is it for us tonight on this Friday night. It's time now to turn things over to Marnie Hughes and Leland Vittert, who are standing by with a special report on the war in Ukraine. So out of the mouths of babes, hey, guys?
Exactly, Ashley. We do have some good news tonight, though. Russia may be recalibrating the forces, but this is a significant shift in where things stand. And from the mouths of babes, hopefully this little girl has a much better future ahead as this war progresses. Great show tonight. Have a great weekend, Ashley. Thank you.